Whether you're listening on the day, on Tuesday when it comes out, or maybe you don't get around to live for a couple of days and you come back and you listen, whatever has brought you here for whatever reason, I'm glad you're listening. I'm glad you've joined us once again for the 207th installment of the Parish of the Patriots. It's always a fun time. If you're a new listener, we do have a Christian-specific segment. There is some meaning in the title of the show. We do have a Christian-specific segment, a sermon, if you would. That is roughly around the halfway point of the show. Don't be turned off. Listen to it. It's not like what you're going to get in any of these ridiculous churches that are around today. I encourage you to stick around for it. Either way, we do, like any other congregation, we do pass the offering plate around. I like to get that out of the way early, and I don't spend a lot of time on it. We do pass the plate around. You get the show regardless, so it is up to you. But if you get something out of it, it is much appreciated, and it's easy. If you want to be a part of that, go to the bottom of the description page for each show here on Radio Albion. We got snail mail. We got Bitcoin. Got a Monero address down there. Got email. Drop your notes. Got email. If you've got a different crypto, I can probably get you an address for that. Just drop me an email. We can probably make that happen. And again, it is much appreciated. And as I said, I don't spend a lot of time on that. But like I say, it is much appreciated. Let's hit the listener supporter mailbag. GPD, happy Clown World Day. And that's from Mr. T. Every day, every single day is every single day is Clown Day. Here, I read so many things. I cover so many things. And, you know, I saw a story. I'm recording this on Saturday. And before I record the show, just do a quick scan. A quick scan of news headlines. Just make sure. Because I would feel stupid if I recorded the show and then checked the headlines and it's like World War III has officially gone hot. And here I am. I'm talking about some rambling crap y'all don't care about. Everybody's getting nuked. Of course, if you're getting nuked, you're probably not listening to the Parish of the Patriots. You're going to wish you had it downloaded so you could listen to it later in the bunker. While you wait to die of radiation poisoning, you would be listening to me. What a way to go. What a way to go. Anyway, I skimmed through the news headlines, and I saw a headline, and it said, U.S. government announces they're going to call off the search for the shot down UFOs. And it's like, yeah, that's because there's nothing there. The only proof we ever had that even happened was they told us it happened. Imagine they just come out and say, we shot down some UFOs. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, the media says they shot down UFOs. I wonder where they're at. The UFOs are real in their minds. They're real in their minds. It's real in the minds of the governments, real in the minds of the media, but it is not real. Imagine they shoot down UFOs and they're just like, we're just going to leave them out there. There couldn't be anything interesting in it. It's just too complicated to go find this debris. Space aliens laying out there. They're just going to leave them. There's space aliens in it. You can just wait for the buzzards to be circling around. And you go out there. We got this alien technology. We shot them down with what would be, you know, of course, obviously, if aliens could get here, they're way more advanced than us. But you see, we've got that fighter plane now, that stealth fighter that crashes all the time. We have reached the pinnacle of advancement now because we can shoot them down. They can't stand up to America, let me tell you. I seen that Independence Day movie. We kicked them aliens' ass, let me tell you. That movie Battleship, aliens showed up. What happened? They thought they were just going to run over the world. Well, they would have run over the world, buddy, except they hadn't counted on one thing. That's right, America. America, step up. Any aliens, they just got to check out the movies, and they'll know America's ready to kick some alien ass. As long as they don't have AK-47s and wear sandals in the desert, they're getting their asses kicked. Shooting down space aliens. They're calling off the search. Do people believe this shit? I don't know. I have very little hope in humanity. Tony, no note from Tony, but I do like to let you know I did get it. And as always, it is very much appreciated. GPD, it's shaping up to be an interesting year. I'm starting to see shortages where I'm at. Gonna get worse before it gets better, I think. Keep your powder dry, all the best. And that's from Jackie. And yeah, we all know it's gonna get worse. So much to look forward to. I lived my early life, you know, before Clown World. I lived my early life like everybody else, thinking, you know, looking forward to things were gonna be better. I do. I feel sorry for younger people today because They don't have that. Younger people today have to live in a world, really, if you think about it. Like, I'm in my 50s, and if you are as well, you have to really be sympathetic. That's why I get mad when I hear older people, whether they're my age or boomers or whatever, you know, and they running down young people. These young people today, they just whatever, fill in the blank. Young people today, think about it. Young people today, they don't know a world where you live your life expecting things to get better. You know, we don't know what that's like. I mean, we know what it's like now. But we knew it was different then. When we were young people, we were, you know, we lived our lives expecting, you know, things were going to get better. We were going to find a better job. We were going to make more money. We were going to have this, that, and then we're going to live a happy, normal life, you know, without insanity, without clown world. I think when people criticize younger generation today, they don't really take into account that these people grow up, younger people grow up today, expecting things to get shittier. That's the world they live in. It's depressing enough to know things used to not be that way and to see them that way now. But how depressing must it be to live your life, you know, not expecting things to just it's inevitable that things are going to get worse. It's inevitible that things are going to get shittier. I think we should have more sympathy. I think it's discouraging. I think it's sad. The world order is in a major transitory, a major shift right now. And we're seeing those that are in power looking ridiculous because they're trying to stop something that's bigger than them. They're trying to stop this shift. And they're getting more and more belligerent and more ridiculous as they do. And I do believe the shift is inevitable. I believe this move to a multipolar world is inevitable. If we had a competent, functioning leadership, government, whatever you want to say, system, they would see this too and try to move in to be a part of that multipolar world. It's not like a multipolar world means everybody but the U.S. It doesn't mean everybody but the West. Germany was doing fine until the U.S. blew up their pipelines. You know, they were doing fine getting along with Russia. Everybody, you know, you work together and you figure out, yes, there's going to be conflicts. Yes, you know, I mean, the world is what it is. Reality is what it is. But, you know, you can find a way, you know, to have agreement where you can and work around conflicts. You know, it doesn't mean everything but the U.S., everyone but the West. But instead of doing that, instead of saying, okay, think times are changing, things are shifting, we got to get in a position to where we're working with people. Shut down these military bases and quit being so belligerent. You know, quit going around being an asshole to everyone on the planet. But they don't. Just keep doubling down. They're fighting against it. You know, they keep doing all these more and more ridiculous things. Yeah, the debacle withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then they, you know, so they could pour resources into fighting Russia and the Ukraine. And now they're trying to wrap that up and jump to the next thing. And it's like, well, what were you trying to accomplish with that? It was like, they're all over the place because they're desperate. They're desperately trying to hold on to power because the times are changing. Times are changing. Times are shifting. This is probably one of the most dangerous times people don't appreciate. With the most dangerous times. Because these lunatics that control this country, you know, they're just detached from reality and they're running around trying to hold on to their power no matter what. And they're still having their wet dreams about ruling the world with a one world government. And obviously that's not going to happen. And so they're trying to just make it happen. And they've demonstrated, as like with the Ukraine, they don't care of how many of the rest of us get killed. If there's a chance, a remote chance, if there's 1% chance that their one world government wet dream can come true, they don't care how many millions of people get killed. Does anybody really think? Does anybody really think the government cares about it? Apparently there are. Apparently there's people that live inside of that delusion that the government cares about them, that the people who rule over them, whether in the government or out, somehow care about them, about what they think, about if anything happens to them. They don't. They don't. If there's a 1% chance they can get their one world government wet dream and the cost of gambling on that, the chips they got to put in, is like 4 million people in the country get nuked, they would do it. If the other option is, yeah, you're going to have to share power in the world. You're going to be a regional power instead of world power. You're going to have to work with other countries, and you're not always going to get your way. We can't have nice things. We can't have nice things. Economy's going to crap. I tell you what, you got all these countries now because the U.S. has demonstrated itself as being completely insane as an entity. And, people are starting to detach from the dollar. And I get into this economic stuff. And I'll say up front, I'm not an expert, but I do read people that know what they're talking about. And I do grasp a certain amount of it. I don't grasp all of the implications of what it means. But I do find one of the things I do find interesting is this ongoing measure, which again is part of this multipolar world thing, is people moving away from the dollar as a reserve currency. This is one of the things that makes the U.S. the unipolar power of the world is the fact that everybody trades in dollars and everybody is moving away from that. It hadn't happened yet. People are impatient. People sit around and go, it's not happening fast enough. You have to understand, historically speaking, this empire is coming apart at a record pace. But one of the things that's happening as part of this is people are moving away. People are moving away from the dollar. They're starting. It can't happen overnight, obviously, but it is, like I say, historically speaking, it's happening very quickly. Now, what does that mean? The quick answer for me is I'm not sure what it means. But when I read other people's opinions, I realize very quickly they're not sure either. Now, the hot take is that when all of these other countries move away from the dollar, all of those dollars that they were previously buying are going to come flooding back into the country and we're going to have hyperinflation. It's a very simplistic take, if I do say so myself. And again, I'm not being arrogant here because I may be the first to admit I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert on these things. But I do understand fundamentally how the system works at a very basic level, at least. In fact, I can see in a sense... I mean, those dollars are going to flood back into the country. Do you think you're going to get some of that? If, say, $200 billion that are being held as foreign reserve currencies to do trades in the world suddenly come, quote unquote, flooding back into the country, are you going to get a cut of that money? Well, you're not. Obviously, you're not. So they're not just magically coming into the economy. So it could potentially actually be deflationary. If the money comes back to the Federal Reserve, the money comes back to the banks, then it's actually deflationary. This is where it gets interesting. And I don't want to be too geeky about this because, again, I am not an expert. That's why, but I do. I cringe, as you all know, because one of the things I whine about on a semi-regular basis is when I hear people use the term the government printing all of this money because that's not how it works. I hate seeing that term because people get it in their head. The government prints all of this money. They're just going to keep printing the money. But it doesn't work that way. Remember Ben Bernanke? Everybody called him Helicopter Ben. Ben Bernanke. Back in 08, back in 08, and he got the name Helicopter Ben because he made the statement that if he could, he would drop money out of helicopters on the people to try to get the economy going. And it's very interesting because... it's an admission that that's not how it works. The money printers would say, yeah, see, they printed all of this money, but that's not how it works. Always remember, if nothing else, and I understand the money printing thing is used as a convenient term. I'm not going to say I've never used it myself, and I probably will use it again in the future because it is. It's a convenient term to use, but it's not a correct term. The money is not simply printed. You don't just simply get a check from the Federal Reserve. An allowance to live off of. Always remember, the money has to be borrowed to come into existence. It does. That's how it gets into. That's why Ben Bernanke couldn't drop it out of helicopters. He's got to get people to borrow it. But understand, this whole system is based on this. And of course, there's always more money owed than there is in circulation. Why our ancestors that allowed the Federal Reserve to be set up thought that that was a sustainable idea in the first place, I just have to assume they were so corrupt, they took payments, they took bribes. And of course, now they're all dead, probably in hell. That is a certain amount of reassurance that they're at least probably in hell, seeing the mess they made. The idea you can have a system to where more money is always going to be owed because interest is being charged. So there's always going to be more owed than there is in existence. And this is going to somehow be a sustainable system. That's why the Federal Reserve will always say, the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, all of them will always say their target goal. The Federal Reserve will say a target goal is 2% inflation. You ever ask yourself why the target goal is not deflation? I believe one of the reasons is because due to interest being owed, there's always going to be more money owed than there is in existence. So you're going to have inflation. Deflation is what keeps them up at night. Understand that. Deflation is what keeps the Federal Reserve up at night. This is what gives them nightmares. When the Federal Reserve, all the Federal Reserve board members are laying there sleeping. Remember, they're not the federal government. I hate that they have the term federal in their name because people think that's the government. But they have nothing to do with the government. These are the big banks that control everything. At least everything pertaining to the money supply. What keeps the Federal Reserve board members, like when they wake up in a cold sweat, when they wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night and had a really bad dream, they're not dreaming about hyperinflation. They're dreaming about any sort of deflation. That's what keeps them up at night. They have to have inflation to keep this thing going. Because again, there's always more money owed than there is in existence. So if they don't have inflation, if they have deflation, it's bad for the bankers. It's a very, very bad for the system. What passes for money printing is the government borrowing it. Not the government is printing money. They're not. The government is the borrower of last resort. And that's what they're down to now. Because the people are all tapped out. Back in the 80s and 90s, they opened up the credit spigot. Everybody got credit cards. And you could get loans. And people were borrowing money. And those were considered boom times. They were considered boom times because credit spigot was open. People were able to borrow money. And everything was flowing in the system. But see, now everybody's tapped out. That's why Ben Bernanke said, I wish I could drop money out of the helicopter. Because he understood everybody's tapped out. We want to get this money into circulation. And you sit here and say, well, what about when they sent out those stimulus checks? The Federal Reserve didn't give those out. The government did. Where did they get the money? They borrowed it. That's what I'm saying. The Federal Reserve is now down to the borrower of last resort, which is the U.S. government. And to another extent, other governments around the world that have to borrow that money to keep it in reserve so that they're able to do trades. But see, now those borrowers are starting to wean themselves off the system. You wonder why they hate your credit? Like one of the things that'll hurt your credit, there's two things that actually will hurt your credit here in the U.S. I don't know about everywhere else, but I assume it all works the same because it's the same system. Two things hurt your credit. One, not paying your bills, obviously. Like if you got, I'm thinking in terms, let's say credit card. You got a credit card. And there's two things that will ding your credit. The first one is obvious if you don't pay the bill. If you run up a $3,000 credit card bill and don't pay it, that's a major ding on your credit. The other thing, though, they quietly ding you on your credit for is if you pay the balance every month and they don't get to make any interest on it. That's the other thing they don't like. It actually dings your credit rating. I have heard people in life, and they find out their credit score is not as high as they think, and they're like, why is my credit score low? I pay all my bills off every month. Ding, ding, ding. That's why. That's why. Both of these things are deflationary. If you run up $3,000 on your credit card bill, they're able to, you know, that's inflationary, obviously, because that's how the money gets into circulation. And again, I get deep into this, and at some point it's going to be obvious that, you know, I don't know all of the ramifications of this, and I'm not pretending to know, but it is interesting. It's interesting to at least delve into it as far as we can. We may not be able to come to a final answer, but we can understand it up to a point. So when you default on that, that essentially goes back to them. They have to eat it. That's something they never want you to know, too, by the way. Like if you default on your credit cards, that's unsecured debt. They can raise hell, they can harass you all they want, but they can't come get your shit. That's deflationary because it essentially takes it out. Now, what does that mean as these other big players, these different nations in the world start weaning themselves off of these dollars? That essentially means they start paying that back. It means they start giving that back. Again, they're not going to give it to you. It's going somewhere. Where's that money going to go? If it basically winds up going back to the Federal Reserve, this is deflationary in pressure. It's very interesting. Like I say, that's why the government comes up. The government's a borrower of last resort. That's why they come up with all these ridiculous infrastructure schemes and the money just gets wasted because there's so much corruption. They just pay each other off and yet the infrastructure gets worse and worse. They spend all of this money on infrastructure, on education, and none of those things get any better. They all get worse because the money's just going into people's pockets. But that's why that has to happen. It's not because they care. Well, I mean, they do care about stealing the money, which they do. While they don't fix the highway, while they don't fix the railroad. But they do. They have to borrow that money. They're the borrower of last resort. If the government suddenly balanced the budget, they're having this stupid, ridiculous puppet show right now in Washington about this debt ceiling. Like, they're not going to raise it. This is just show. It is. It's ridiculous. It's just show. Of course they're going to raise it because they have to keep the scam going as long as they can. I remember when they passed that law about the debt ceiling and then the Republicans were like, this is going to force the government to balance their budget. Of course, they gave themselves an out. The Congress could vote to simply raise it, which they do every single time. It was just show. TMR was out there parading around. Finally, we're going to force federal government to balance their budget. Then they didn't. TMR just goes along with Team D and votes to raise the debt ceiling every single time. They have to. Look, they have no choice. If the federal government stopped borrowing money, if the federal government said, we are going to have, this is our budget. This is our budget. We're not going to borrow any more money. Doesn't matter what we got to cut. Obviously, that's not going to happen until it does happen, until they just can't anymore. If they did that, what would that mean? It means the inflationary cycle. And that's what I say. Everybody keeps reading hyperinflation into everything. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. Because if the government ceases to borrow money, if they were to cease, theoretically, to cease borrowing money, then they're essentially the borrower of last resort. Everybody else is tapped out. Everybody else can't borrow no more money. That's a deflationary pressure. And now what's interesting about that, obviously the government's not going to do that, but at the same time, it is inevitable that the government's debt level will come to the point at some point that they're not able to even, you know, the interest on the debt just takes up the whole budget. You know, they wind up being the person that's borrowing money on their credit card to make the minimum payment on the other credit card, and it's the debt spiral. At some point, that kicks in, and then they will no longer be able to borrow them. It just won't be mathematically possible. Then what happens? And I don't know the answer. I mean, we go this far with it, and I don't know the answer. But I don't think it's so simplistic as, you know, we're going to have hyperinflation, and, you know, the government's just going to keep printing money, because that's not how it works. It's just simply not how it works. Again, it's, I don't know the final answer. I don't know what that final picture looks like. But it is something interesting to consider. But you see, most people don't consider. We just have to sit around and talk about UFOs. UFOs, drag queen story hours, the latest purple-haired, you know, lunatic idiot woman with the problem glasses on TikTok talking about how she's going to turn her first graders into trannies, whatever, you know, whatever. I mean, all of this is somebody, you know, crank up some more race stuff, you know, crank up some more race conflict. They got to keep everybody dancing around so nobody's sitting around going, so what's it going to mean when the dollar is no longer the global reserve currency? They don't want you asking those questions. They don't want you asking things like, well, we can't, the military's not going to be able to win a war with Russia and China. Against Russia and China, what does that mean for us? Aren't you asking that? Look, here's another outrageous TikTok video. Look, they're having a debate in Congress over social media, you know, censoring people. We all know nothing's going to come of it, but look, here it is. Here's a dancing dog show or some other crap. That's all it is. It's just theater. Just theater. And it's not just being jaded. You know, you say that and people be like, you're just jaded. You're just, well, yeah, I kind of am. But that is reality. It's reality. It's all of this crap is just theater. And you still, I see this ridiculous stuff. And it's funny when you see people doing this. Like, we have this horrible, one of the things I think that is a distraction with this whole UFO nonsense is they're distracting from that environmental disaster in Ohio, this train derailment. And we got to get into the next segment. I got to talk about this, though. I really should have talked about this earlier. You got the government coming. These are the people that are telling us that carbon dioxide is now magically a pollutant. The thing you breathe out is killing the planet. The thing you breathe out and that plants breathe in, and in exchange for that, the plants breathe out oxygen so that you can breathe it in. Oh my gosh, it almost sounds like a higher being designed all of this. It works so well. The very same people that tell you carbon dioxide is poisoning and killing the planet, and you need to quit having, you know, eating meat because cows are killing the planet, show up at this derailment and light off extremely toxic, cancerous, dangerous chemicals. And they tell everybody it's fine. It's fine. Nothing to see here. The media does a blackout on it. They've started finally begrudgingly talking about it because so many people are aware of it. It's not, their radio silence isn't really helping. They're just trying to act like it didn't happen. The very government that's telling you what you breathe out is killing the planet lights off thousands of gallons of extremely scary toxic chemicals. And it's running off and people's animals are dying and the fish are floating dead in the river. And they're like, it's all right. Everybody go home. It's amazing. Okay. Corruption. The corruption is reaching a point to where we see, you know, this breakdown of everything. You know, touching on it earlier, you know, the infrastructure is crumbling. They spend trillions of dollars that supposedly goes to infrastructure. And you know, the highways are crap. The railroads are crap. All of these things are crap. Bridges are crap. You look at China and they have these bullet trains that go 200 miles an hour and they're clean and sleek and futuristic looking. We can't even run 50-year-old looking locomotives without them falling off the tracks. The corruption, they spend all of this money and nobody knows where the money goes. The Pentagon is a black hole. Republicans right now, part of their negotiations, we need to be spending even more on the defense. But yes, because it's so well managed. The conservatives, you know, they're so budget conscious. Doesn't bother them that nobody even knows where this Pentagon money. Every time they try to audit the Pentagon, it doesn't work because the money just disappears and they're fine with it. Going to raise that debt ceiling as long as we can give some more to the military industrial complex. You know, the corruption. You spend billions of dollars on education and kids are dumber today than they've ever been. I spent billions of dollars on the Environmental Protection Agency and they light off toxic chemicals and tell you it's okay. Meanwhile, telling you that what we really got to worry about is the weather. You're changing the weather by existing. It's all corruption. This money is just going in these different pockets and the corruption is just like at a critical mass. Everything is breaking down. Nothing is functioning. You know, people still have this illusion. That's why I say, people like, how can you be so sure the U.S. can't win a war against Russia and China? Because the U.S. military is an extension of the government. And every other aspect of this system is breaking down and not functioning. Everybody's living in the past that the U.S. military is this mighty, unbeatable force. And I think it's an illusion. And if they do get into a hot conflict, and I think it's more likely than not, if they do get into a hot conflict, I think that illusion bubble is going to get popped very quickly. And when it does, it's all going to come crashing down. You know, it's just like, you know, you have normie conservative types, you know, bless their hearts. And they will sit there and tell you how corrupt every aspect of the government is. But when it comes to the military, all of a sudden, they're the good guys. They're absolutely the good guys, my heroes and all of this. Look, the military is just the government. It's the officially armed wing of the government. They get the big cannons. I mean, that government has armed wings all over all of these alphabet agencies, but the alphabet agencies don't control nuclear weapons. The military is just as corrupt and by extension, just as inept as all of the rest of the government. The military is no different than the EPA, which lights off thousands of gallons of extremely frighteningly toxic chemical and tells you, no, No problem. Ignore the dead animals in your yard. Ignore the dead fish that are floating in the water that you're ultimately going to drink. It's okay. That water, when you drink it, safe because we're putting fluoride in it because we care about your teeth. The military is the same thing. All this money is going into the military. People say it's the most mighty. Man, I got to get into the next section. I'm rambling. I'm sorry. You know, the most of America is the strongest, mightiest military in the world. Just watch any movie, buddy. You're going to see. We can kick aliens' ass. It's so awesome. It's just corrupt as the rest of it. It's the mightiest military in the world on paper, just going by budget numbers. You know, umpteen quadrillion dollars get spent on the military. It must mean they must be the best. It's just, you know, we have planes that won't fly. Nobody's competent enough to hit the fire button to put the fire out on a ship. And we make ships that don't work that have to be scrapped. The corruption reaches critical mass. Everything ceases to function. We got to get into the Christian specific segment. I could go on about this. Sorry. But that's what we're here. We're here to listen to me ramble. Now, well, maybe part of that, but we're also here to get into our Christian specific segment. So you know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon here at the Parish of the Patriots. As I've probably mentioned before, my current Old Testament reading is in the book of First Samuel, and I have to stop there. And once again, wine, what a shame it is that the churches, the so many of the churches now, and, you know, sadly, Christian, by extension, Christian believers in general today shy away from and shun the Old Testament. I mean, you're missing out on, you know, there. I don't think y'all are shying away. But they're missing out. They're missing out on so much by not reading the Old Testament, by discarding the Old Testament. And it really is. It's a shame. And it's easy to understand. It's easier to understand how the MCC created this false notion of, you know, modern hippie peace and love Jesus. You know, it's easier to understand how they're able to do that when they first discarded the Old Testament. They were able to create like this false notion, this false picture of Christ. But anyway, with that amount of whining out of the way, I'm currently reading in the book of First Samuel. And by the way, I'm not going to have any specific, we're not going to read any specific Bible verses, but you can go and read the book of First Samuel. It's encourage you to do so. You don't have to do it all at once. But you could sum up most of the book of First Samuel, so much of the book of First Samuel, as Saul versus David. At least that's what it seems like on its face. So King Saul, who was king at the time, Saul versus David. But actually, when you look into it deeper, it's actually Saul versus the Lord. Saul is actually fighting against God, as it were. Now, Saul was put into place as king through Samuel by the Lord. But he got sideways with God. There come a point God had given him specific instructions on what to do. And instead, he went off and did his own thing. And again, I'm just summarizing it. I'm kind of covering a broad topic as to the book of 1 Samuel here. So again, I don't have specific passages to read. You can read it yourself. I encourage you to do so. Anyway, he had been given specific instructions, and he winds up not following those instructions. And to make matters worse, when he gets called out on it, Samuel shows up, and basically he gets called out on it. And instead of just fessing up to it, he basically tries to lie about it. He tries to justify not following God's instructions. This puts him in conflict with God. And you can see, obviously the first mistake he made was not following God's very straightforward instructions of what to do and what not to do. It was one of those, by the way, those instructions were very, very Old Testament-like, which is basically kill everything in this city and don't leave a single thing living. And they failed to do that. They wound up plundering the animals and taking the wealth and things such as this. Now, on the surface, you're like, why would God do that? And you can kind of, the way I see it and the way I think it's to understand that is, it separates doing it at the behest of the Lord versus just, you know, doing another plundering and conquering, which was so common in those days. People get all hung up and they're like, why would the Israelites, they go in there and kill all these people? Well, those people would do the same to them given the chance. That was the times they lived in. That was the reality they lived in. Very harsh reality. Now, it's very typical if you had up a fighting force and you said, hey, we can go in here and take this city and take their stuff. You know, we'd take their women, we'd take their gold, we'll take everything that's worth any value. We may just take over the city and that'll be ours. And that was at the behest of men. That was just the driving of men's hearts. See, when the Lord had told them to go in and wipe the city out, and you're not allowed to take anything, you're supposed to just wipe everything out. That's the difference. If you go in, as soon as Saul made the decision just to go in and plunder everything and then kill the people, you see, that would just made it another act of man. It removed that this is the Lord. Because, see, it, at the behest of the Lord, you're doing it with no gain for yourself. You're doing it just because this is what God wants you to do. There's nothing in it for you. You don't get to take their gold. You don't get to take their livestock. It just, there's nothing in it for you. And this sets it apart. This is not a dealing of man. God has judged against his people and said, they're not going to have a place in this world anymore. Again, I know in these modern touchy-feely times, this sounds extremely harsh, but these were the times they lived in. This was the reality. Again, you can see why the creation of modern hippie peace and love Jesus is so utterly ridiculous. They had to first discard the Old Testament, the reality of the Old Testament, and get into more of this. And we probably will at some point in the future as to why God would set them out to wipe some of these peoples out. We're not going to get into all of that today. But Saul was given these instructions, and he was supposed to do this so that it would be clear that this was from God. This wasn't just guys going in there and plundering it so they could, you know, take the people's stuff. And when they did that, they took away from the fact that this was something the Lord was doing, and they turned it into, hey, look, we got their stuff. Anyway, so Saul gets called out on this, and of course he tries to bullshit his way through it, is typical human nature, tries to justify what he's done and tries to lie about it and twist things around. But you can't game your way around the Lord. That never works. So Samuel goes out and the Lord says, yeah, I'm done with this guy. We're going to point out, I'm going to show you somebody else that's going to become the next king, which, of course, as you probably know, is David. So the Lord winds up having Saul anoint David as the next king. Of course, the problem is you still have a king in place. You still have Saul in place. And this sets up the conflict. And we have this conflict. Now, Saul, whether it's because of the responsibilities of the position or the fact that in his heart of hearts, he knows he's in conflict with God, for whatever reason, Saul basically goes nuts. I mean, the guy really does. I find it interesting. I find Saul to be one of the more interesting characters of the Old Testament. And he kind of doesn't get much airtime. But of course, and again, the Old Testament in general doesn't get much playtime. Saul's an interesting character. Saul loses his mind. I mean, he has moments of sanity and moments where he's lucid and he understands what's going on. And then just like flipping a switch, he'll go crazy. You know, he will sit there. There'll be times that, you know, he's sitting at the table with David and he's like, man, this guy, you know, David, he's all right. And then, you know, he's done this great thing. And then you flip a switch and he'll jump up and throw a spear at him and try to kill him. But he's lost his mind. You know, the Bible describes this as an evil spirit from the Lord. And of course, evil not being wicked, it means a bad spirit. And I think it's just basically a way of saying he's nuts. He basically has lost his mind. He comes in and out of sanity. He gets emotionally driven extremely easy. And because of this, he winds up getting manipulated easily, and this doesn't get a lot of play. You kind of have to read between the lines. It's there, you know, but it's pretty subtle. Because Saul is so emotionally unstable, You know, again, he'll have moments when he's fairly he's lucid and he seems to have a grasp on things, but then he's really emotionally unstable and he'll go off the deep end. Because of this, he has people around him that discover, lo and behold, it's really easy to manipulate the king because he's so emotionally unstable. All you got to do is push his buttons and he'll go off, and you can get what you want. You can get a result you want by getting him off in these other directions. Now, we have to stop for a minute and think about the vanity of, I hate, words and language have been distorted to the point that I feel like I have to stop and again explain what we mean by the word vanity, even though it's pretty straightforward. And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to like patronize anybody, but I realize that people lose track of what words talk about because in our world today, words are constantly twisted. We don't mean vanity in the sense that you think of like something you see on TV and say, that's a vain person. They, you know, it's a woman. She looks in the mirror and thinks of how beautiful she is. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about doing something in vain, something without a meaning, something that is pointless. The vanity of fighting against God. David is going to be the next king. Not, you know, Saul is going to lose being king, and moreover, Saul's son is not going to become the next king. He's not going to become the heir. Now, this is funny because his son Jonathan is a total bro with David. I've heard where these things are so insulting. I have to really bite my tongue. So-called preachers in the church that unsurprisingly puts homosexual agenda, I've heard there have been people that have tried to, where people have tried to infer that David and Jonathan had a homosexual relationship, and that is only because they've taken and twisted the word of the meaning of the word love to the point where they can't understand where two men can deeply love each other and not equate some sort of weird sex bullshit to it. It's just disgusting. But y'all are all, this is the advanced course. Y'all are all here. Y'all are in the advanced course. I don't have to explain that to you. Jonathan was a total bro to David. I mean, they were one heart. Now, you would think if anybody was going to be upset that they weren't going to be the next king, it would be Jonathan. But Jonathan was actually fine with it. Jonathan kept trying to intercede between his father, Saul, and David, even to the point of protecting David at risk of his own life. You see, Saul at times would justify what he's doing. He's like, I'm doing this for you, son. But he's not. He's doing it for his own pride. He's doing it for his own self. He's doing it because he's now dug into this conflict against the Lord. And he keeps justifying. He's still justifying what he's doing. You see, once you take that step off into justifying what you're doing, not being honest, justifying what you're doing, you dig yourself into a rebellion, a fighting against God, and it only gets worse. Saul will sit there and tell Jonathan, hey, I'm doing this for you, son. You're supposed to be the next king. And Jonathan's like, I really don't care about that. David's my bro, man. I care about my friend. I care about this man who's like a brother to me more than I care about being a king. I don't really care about that anyway. David and Jonathan are complete bros. I mean, they have a deep bond, a deep friendship. Again, Jonathan saves David's life from the hand of Saul. You know, that's how deep their bond is, that he'll protect him from his own father. Now, again, Saul is trying to justify, one of his justifications is, I'm doing this for you. Obviously, he's not, because his son doesn't care about this. Now, David is going to be the next king. Saul is fighting against God over this. And, you know, and you think about, as you get through Saul's end, we're not going to get to that today, but, you know, Saul doesn't have a real pleasant ending, and he doesn't have a real pleasant time as king. He doesn't have a real pleasant ending. And you think about it, it's like anywhere along in here, he could have just stopped. And I talked about, you know, when you start justifying, when you start making these excuses, you refuse to be honest with yourself, and thus you're not going to be honest with God, and you're not going to be honest with the people around you, and you get dug into this position of conflict where you're fighting against God. At any point in time, listen, as long as you're alive here on the earth, you can do something different. You don't have to keep doing the same thing. At any point in time, Saul could have just said, stopped. He could have just stopped and could have said, you know what, Lord, You're going to make David the next king. Okay. To make things easier, my son's fine with that. You know, in fact, I don't really have to worry, because you have to understand, in these ancient monarchies, is very, you know, it's pretty much standard practice. If somebody not in the bloodline took over as the next king, it was standard practice that the new king would go in and slaughter everybody from the former king's family. This is standard operating procedure, and everybody knows this. Standard operating procedure, you go in, if you're not inside the bloodline, that's why they had bloodline inheritance. They had bloodline inheritance so there wouldn't be a conflict. The eldest son becomes the next king, and there you go. And in some monarchies, the eldest son would take the throne, and then he would kill all his siblings just to avoid future conflict. Because again, there's always going to be people around. People now, because they don't understand how these things work, you know, they think the king had absolute word, and there you go, and everybody just went along and obeyed. Can you imagine human beings being that obedient? No, they're plotting, they're scheming, they're always trying to come up with their own, you know, a way to get their own means, their own agendas. So when somebody not inside the bloodline took over, he was standard operating procedure. They would go and slaughter everybody, every descendant, everybody related to the former king's family. Why? So nobody else could come in and say, hey, I've got this, you know, they would find some child that was related and say, this child is the true heir to the throne. And they would use that as a justification, stir up a rebellion. And then, of course, ideally, put this child on the throne. Of course, he's not able to make these decisions, so I will help the king. I will be an advisor to our young king. These are the type of agendas that tended to happen. But David was a bro with Jonathan. That wasn't going to happen. Saul at any point could have told the Lord, you know what? I'm going to stop this. He could have stepped forward and said, you know what, I'm gonna abdicate my throne. The Lord himself has set David to be the next king. Could have handed that to David. And I'll take up a supporting role. You know, I will take up the supporting role. Jonathan, by all indications, would have simply remained in the palace and would have been David's right-hand man. Saul could have took up a supporting role. Would have probably just wound up being a general in the army or something like that. Or he could have retired, you know, or been a palace advisor or something like that. And he would have undoubtedly wound up with a more pleasant end than he ultimately gets. Now, by the time if you get to 1 Samuel chapter 24, Saul has been going out with thousands of guys trying to kill David. He's got around 600 dudes or so, different people that have picked up and followed him. And they've gone in and defended cities. Defended cities from the Philistines and stuff, and Saul will randomly take up a bunch of guys and go out there and try to kill David. He's made multiple attempts on David's life, and these people that are with David, his men that are with him, they're fighting with him. You know, they follow him. Their lives are in David's hands. They believe that the Lord has anointed him; he's going to be the next king. But besides that, he's a man of honor. They respect him. You know, his whole history is one of being upright, you know, and everything they know about the guy is, you know, you always have to remember loyalty is a two-way street. There's no such thing as someone being loyal to a leader, to someone who wants to lead men. Your men are never going to be loyal to you unless they know that you're going to be loyal to them back. You know, you're going to look after them. There's no such thing. Being loyal to a leader who's not loyal to his men is that's just folly. That's just foolishness. That's just MAGA. You know, example of that folly is when Trump threw all of those January 6 people under the bus without issuing a pardon before leaving office because it'd make him look bad. He demonstrated no loyalty. That's why I think it's silly for people to run around and still be all, you know, Trump, 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 as if, you know, like you owe the man some loyalty. He's got real loyalty because he has loyalty towards his men. So they're dedicated and loyal to him. Now, this means their lives are in his hands. When God says, go into this city and defend it against the Philistine with your 600 guys, even though you're outnumbered, he's taking those guys into these fights and their lives are in his hands. They're following him in because they believe in him. And he has a lot of responsibility here. And these guys are going to follow him. It's no small thing. At one point, he goes in and defends the city against Philistines. Saul hears about it. Instead of being, hey, that's great, he goes heading out that way so he can try to kill David and, of course, his guys that are with him. And David inquires of the Lord. I'm getting off on something different than what I wanted to actually talk about here. But David inquires of the Lord. And it's like, is Saul going to march out against me? And it's like, yep. Will the people of this city, which I just saved from the Philistines, will they hand me over to Saul? Yep. That's how it is. You just defended these people and they're going to turn around and they're going to kick you out, hand you over to Saul because it's convenient. They don't want to be inconvenienced. They don't want to put themselves out or put themselves in any sort of danger or conflict, even though you just saved them. So he leaves the city. Anyway, the background here, which I was trying to get to, it's just so interesting to me. I keep getting hung up on every little detail. Saul has been going out. He's been trying to kill David and by extension, the people that are with him for a while now. Well, Saul winds up marching out on one of his expeditions because advisors and people are telling him David's out there. David's out there. Needs to you can go kill him. He's up here hiding in this area, in this general area. So Saul goes marching out. Of course, they don't know specifically where he's at. They'll hear he's in this area and they'll go out there and looking. But Saul and his dudes are really good at hiding. Now, Saul goes out, marches out. They're on this expedition. And in chapter 24, you know, like I say, they don't know where David's at. They're a lot closer than what he thinks. Saul takes off separate from his guys there and goes up into like this cave. He's going to go up there and take a shit. That's where David and his dudes are all hiding in this cave. So Saul goes in there and he's all squatted down, relieving himself. And David and his dudes are right there. Well, the guys that are with David are like, here it is, bro. This guy has been chasing us for some time now. He's tried to kill you and by extension us a long time. And they tell him, the Lord has surely delivered Saul into your hand this day. This is interesting to me because what do you do when you know God is doing something and it might on the surface look like God is coming through? You got all these guys around you and they're like, man, the Lord has delivered to me. He isn't going to be delivered into your hand more than this. Look at this. He's right there. That's tempting. You know, that is extremely tempting. It would be justified in every sense. I mean, Saul has been trying to kill him without any, you know, for no reason, except that he's just jealous and fighting against God and basically a lunatic. They're like, dude, he's right here. Now, David has to make a decision here. And understand, it's not just a decision simply for himself. These people, these men who are with him, who are loyal, who will follow him if he says, we're going to charge into this wall of fire. They're going to follow him through the wall of fire. Of course, it's easier when they're actually following. Again, this was back in days when they had true leaders. They didn't have people that sat in a nice, comfortable office far off somewhere and issued orders and said, y'all go off into the fire. They would literally follow him into that fire. Even if they thought this doesn't make any sense, this guy's crazy, they would do that. That's the kind of loyalty they had. It's one thing to make decisions for yourself. It's another thing when you make decisions that are going to affect people that you know. I mean, you know, they've proven themselves. They've got your back. That's a burden. That's a heavy responsibility. He knows these people. He has a relationship with these people. They have shown him loyalty. They have followed him in through thick and thin. They have followed him into the mouth of battles where they're outnumbered and fought together and lived together. That burden of responsibility, the decision he makes here, and it's not just his life. It's these guys' lives. If he makes the wrong decision here, it's not just him that's going to be killed. All of his men are going to be killed. These men who showed him such loyalty. If you don't understand what a weight that is, you really need to reflect on what that means. You know, on the price, how valuable a thing it is to have for people to have that kind of loyalty, for men to have that kind of loyalty to one another. It's very, very scarce, almost to the point of being extinct in this world today. You know, it is. It is. You basically go through this life expecting no loyalty from anybody because that's how this world is today. But it wasn't for them. It wasn't for David. These men were loyal to him. Their very lives were at stake here. And again, these men, it's one thing if people like you don't care about are telling you something, you can brush that off. But when people who have that kind of loyalty that you care about and they care about you are sitting here telling you, look, God, the Lord has delivered him into your hands. You're just, this guy keeps trying to kill you for no reason. He's crazy. He's going to lead the kingdom to destruction. Here he is. God brought him up here. He's by himself. He's squatted down. And David has to make a decision. It looks like, and he's got people telling him, the Lord has delivered him into his hand. And David has to make a decision. And this is interesting because David says, he doesn't say, you have to infer from this. He has to question, is God going to have me? I know God said he's going to have me become king. And he has to believe that, you know, if God has said he's going to become king, that it's going to happen. Understand, you couldn't prevent it if you tried. And this is something you can take heart in. If God is truly going to do something in your life, you're not going to screw it up. If he says he's going to do it, it's going to happen. And I would think that David had to ask himself, because really the internal conflict here isn't really covered. We're just told that the men are like, the Lord's delivered him into your hands and so on and so forth. But you have to think that David asked himself, would the Lord truly have, I mean, you know, the Lord said, I'm going to become king. I know this. But would God really have me become king by striking down the former king while he's taking a shit? Is that something God would really do? Is that an honorable way that I would ascend the throne? I mean, sure, I would ascend the throne. I would ascend the throne. But, you know, because David was popular with the people. He was a populist. He was a popular among the people. Saul's son, Jonathan, was a bro. He wouldn't have, you know, he wouldn't have put up a stink. He could have ascended the throne. But he would always be the king who ascended the throne by killing the last king while he was taking a dump, by stabbing him in the back, by cutting his head off while he was crapping. I can make all kinds of tongue twisters. all kinds of tongue twisters here, you know. Dropping the king while he was dropping a log. There's any kind of vulgar crude humor I could make here. It kind of spoiled the whole mood. I'm sorry. Do I really want to become the king, though, that will always be known as the king who ascended the throne by killing the last king by basically when he was defenseless, not in some kind of head-to-head battle, when he was defenseless taking a crap? Is that really something God would do? David makes the decision that, you know, look, God says I'm going to become the king. I'm going to become the king regardless, but I'm not going to become the king like this. I'm not going to be the guy who becomes king because he killed the last king while he was taking a crap. Dishonor, this would dishonor both Saul. Because remember, Saul, for all his faults, was originally put there by God. And it would dishonor David himself. David had carried himself with honor up to this point. That's why he had loyalty from his men. Everybody knew if he said he would do something, he would do it. It would dishonor everybody involved. So in the end, and again, David has to make this decision quick. I mean, Saul in there reading a newspaper. He's got to make this decision quick. So he makes the decision that, you know, God isn't going to have me become king like this. I'm not going to do it. I've got people that I care about telling me I should do it. I got all of this. But at the end of the day, it's his decision to make. It's always your decision. There's times when it's your decision to make. Others can advise you. Others can tell you, give you their pointers or even pressure you. But it's your decision to make. He decides that he's not going to become king in such a dishonorable way. But now he does still have these other people's lives in his hands. You know, there's going to be consequences for every decision. What he does do is he slips up with his knife and he cuts the back off of Saul's, they say his skirt. Understand, it's not like women's clothing. You've seen pictures of people back then. You can understand. Cuts the back off his deal. Saul gets up, never has an idea this is going on. And he goes out there back to his guys. David, in a gutsy move. We're going to wrap up here. But David, in his gutsy move, comes down out and hollers at him. And, you know, he makes it a point. He says, look, you know, he holds this up. Imagine Saul being like, what's back here? And he's like, look, you got people telling you I'm after you and I'm after the throne. I'm going to kill you because I want the throne. Looky here. I was so close, I cut the back off your skirt while you were taking a crap, dude. I could have cut your throat. I could have cut your head off if that's what I wanted to do. Why are you out here? Why are you chasing me? Why do you keep coming after me to kill me? Here, look at here. I could have killed you if I wanted to. Now what? And in a moment of lucidity, Saul says, look, yeah, I know you're going to be the next king. Just promise me that you're not going to wipe my house out. And David does. He swears Saul that he won't do this. He won't, you know, like I said, we've already covered before, his standard operating procedure, that you're going to kill everybody and their family, related, distant relatives, everything, so that there's no future political turmoil. There's no future conflict over the throne. And David says, yeah, you've got my word. I won't do that. Or he still didn't abdicate the throne. He could have done that and quit rebelling against God. He does not do that. But in this instance, he does pack up and leave David alone. He doesn't try to kill him this time. And he goes ahead and packs up and goes home. The interesting part of the story, and like I said, we're going to wrap up on that note because I kind of gone over a lot. And because there's so much interesting here. And you can understand how people are lied to when they're told there's nothing interesting. There's nothing pertaining, there's nothing, you know, that could mean anything to you in this Old Testament stuff. You know, there's nothing in there. But there is so much here. It's interesting because in this case, you've got this background, and David has now been presented an opportunity where you could very much say it looks like God is doing something. But you have to ask yourself, is he really? Is this really the way God is going to have me do this? Be very tempting to, you know, he could end this conflict finally once and for all right here. Just, you know, cut this guy's throat, chop his head off, whatever he's going to do right here while he's taking a dump and he won't be chasing him, trying to kill him anymore. It's very tempting. It's a very difficult decision, made more difficult by the fact that he's got his men's lives are in his hands as well, They hang in the balance of his decision. It's also interesting that his men, speaking of his men's loyalty, they honored his decision. When David decided not to do that, there wasn't any of his men that jumped up and said, if you won't do it, I'll do it. And they run out there and kill the king. They honored his decision, even though they knew what happened next could mean they're going to die. Tell me that isn't loyalty. Tell me that isn't valuable. It's all very interesting, very good. It's a shame people don't read the Old Testament more. There is a lot there. I realize we've kind of just gone the quick version, kind of the summary version over all of this. But it is good, and we should understand that, you know, there are times that you might think, you know, hey, God, here we go. God's going to do this. Here's the opportunity. But you have to ask yourself, is it really? Because if God's going to do it, he's going to do it regardless. You're not going to screw it up. David had to ask himself, is this really what God would do? You know, I'm being presented this here, and on the surface, yeah, boy, it looks like here we go. But is that really what God would do? We always have to have that kind of attitude as well, so that we don't get misled. Again, these things that happened so long ago, they do have a bearing, and they do have a relevance on our lives today. We're going to wrap up on that note. Thank you once again for joining us. I do hope you got something out of it. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. I always enjoy it. By the time I sit down and record the show, I'm always looking forward to it. I just picture you all listening. I do. I enjoy doing the show. Enjoy our time here together. Hopefully you did as well. And hopefully you'll be back to meet us right here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.